This episode of The Business of Watches is brought to you by Panerai. 2025 marks the year of the Luminor, a celebration of bold Italian design, technical innovation, and the legacy of Panerai's most iconic collection. Welcome to the Business of Watches, where horology meets high finance and each tick tells a story of markets, margins, mishaps, and mechanical mastery. I'm your host, Andy Hoffman, Senior Business Editor at Hodinkee. In this series, we dive deep into the global watch industry, a place where centuries-old craftsmanship intersects with billion-dollar valuations, executive brand strategy, and investor speculation. From Swiss valleys to Silicon Valley, we trace the movements shaping this uniquely resilient sector. Just how big is the business of timekeeping? Well, some estimates place the entire watch industry, from ultra-luxury maisons to smartwatches and microbrands, at north of $100 billion globally. But behind that figure is a complex web of legacy, innovation, and ever-shifting consumer tastes and demand. This is the podcast for collectors, analysts, watch buyers and sellers, and anyone who's fascinated by the intersection of wristwear and wealth. Because if time is money, then money is most certainly time. So let's get down to business. So if we're going to do a podcast about the business of watches, there's really only one place to start. That's with Rolex, which is by far the biggest player in the Swiss watch industry, accounting for about one-third of overall sales. When I started covering the Swiss watch industry as a business reporter a few years ago, Rolex's position at the top quickly became evident. And living in Geneva, I began to realize just how important and influential the company and the foundation were to the city. And so I looked for some books on the business history of the company, and to my surprise, there really weren't any. There were scores of books about Rolex watches, but few, if any, focusing on how this Swiss watch brand's business became number one. There's a pretty good reason for that. I've covered a lot of private and even secretive businesses and companies in my time, including Swiss-based commodities traders, a massive but notoriously furtive group of private companies that make billions moving oil and metals around the world and profiting from changes in prices. The traders seemed extremely opaque and secretive. That is, until I started covering Rolex. It's a private company which has been owned and controlled by a charitable trust foundation in Geneva, named for Rolex co-founder Hans Wilsdorf, since 1960. There were no business books on Rolex because the company disclosed almost nothing about its operations, and its archives remained private and inaccessible to the public. Rolex executives, including its CEO, didn't give interviews about the watchmaker's business. Analysts were left to make estimates about the company's sales and profit. Now, I say there were no business-focused books on Rolex, but that changed in 2024 when Pierre-Yves Danzay, a professor of business history at Osaka University in Japan, published La Fabrique de l'Excellence, Une Histoire de Rolex, which translates roughly to The Factory of Excellence, A History of Rolex. Recently, the book was translated and published in English for the first time. It's called The Making of a Status Symbol, A Business History of Rolex. It is quite an achievement by Danzay, who is Swiss and was born in the watchmaking hub of La Chaux-de-Fonds and has written several other books about the Swiss watch sector, including A Business History of the Swatch Group. To produce the first fulsome business history of Rolex, he relied on traditional academic research, using primarily archive materials to build his story and narrative. Danzay scoured big government and business archives, records, and journals in Switzerland, the UK, and the US to produce an academic work that, for the first time, sheds light on how Rolex really became number one. And while he informed the company of his project, they did not assist his research, nor did they make the company archives available. So how did he do it? And more importantly, what did he learn? Here's our conversation with Pierre-Yves Danzay, author of The Making of a Status Symbol. Welcome, Pierre-Yves Danzay, professor of business history at the University of Osaka, who has just published his book about the business history of Rolex in English for the first time. It was published in 2024 in French for that market, and now it's been translated into English. So, Pierre-Yves, Professor Danzay, welcome, and thank you for joining us. You have been covering and writing about the business history of the Swiss watch industry for many years. You've published several books on the topic and specific books on specific companies, but you had never written about Rolex and the business history of Rolex. This is the most important and biggest Swiss watch company. Why?
Yeah. Yes. Hello, Andy. Thanks for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be with you here today. Yes, you are right. I've been studying the watch industry in Switzerland and globally for about 15 years, looking at many aspects. And I wanted always to do something about Rolex. But, you know, the most important when you are a historian is to use archives, to use original documents, to avoid, you know, all the narratives that we are surrounded by in the watch industry, just to go back to real documents to understand how this industry developed. And so I could do it for many aspects, different cities, different countries, different companies, but not Rolex because they don't open their archives to historians. And so it was, as we know, you know, it's a very secret company. The CEOs, since decades, have never done any interviews. So the information is very rare. So it's very, very hard to work as a historian on Rolex, yeah, despite it's the number one company in the world.
Absolutely. And so what convinced you or made you believe that you could write the book about Rolex and, you know, that gave you the confidence to do so?
I think there are different factors. First one is time. I spent, as I said, about 15 years in archives looking at different aspects of the watch industry. And even if I've never been to Rolex archives, you find always some documents about Rolex elsewhere, because the company was in contact with so many institutions, government, trade associations, other companies, that you always find the name of Rolex. So it convinced me that it's possible to do something on this company, looking, you know, from another perspective, from the stakeholders of this firm. And so it's just time and experience spent in working on this industry that gave me confidence for that. And second also is that you need also to have a good, I would say, a good point, a good research question. It's not only the history of Rolex. For me, it's to understand how Rolex became a status symbol, no more watch, but a narrative on success. And if you start in this perspective, you can look for information in different perspectives.
Absolutely. And the title of the book in French is La Fabrique d'Excellence. In English, you are calling it The Making of a Status Symbol. Should we read anything into that in terms of that change in title?
No, it was a suggestion by the publisher because I wanted to have something better for the English-speaking market, according to them. And they gave me a few suggestions, and I liked it. Because it's difficult so to translate perfectly French. So there's a manufacturer of excellence. Yeah. What does it mean, excellence? I discuss a lot in the French edition that excellence is the excellence of the watch, but it's also the excellence of the users of the watch. And it makes a narrative on success and excellence. And in English, it's not similar if you use the word excellence than in French. So to translate not literally, but the spirit of the title was better to have the making of a status symbol.
Fair enough. Yeah, makes sense. And indeed, so let's start at the beginning with Hans Wilsdorf and the founding of Rolex, and even before the founding of Rolex. What were the important determining factors that you discovered about Hans Wilsdorf in his early life and then leading up to the founding of Rolex that set the stage for this company?
Looking at Wilsdorf, I think there are two important points, related points. First is that he was a trader. No, he was not an engineer. He was not a producer. So he started selling watches. And this is very important to understand all the development of this company, of this brand, because he gave attention to consumers, to the market first. He knew people, he knew what they wanted, what they didn't want. And after, he went back to Switzerland to find suppliers, thinking about market. It was quite uncommon at the time for the big names. If you think about Omega, Longines, they all started with manufacturing. And so it gives another perspective on the brand development. And related to that, he was looking for a hit product for very early on. But he didn't know what. We always said, either the Oyster. Of course, the Oyster became a good innovation, very famous. But after, when he was developing the Oyster, he didn't know it would become a so big success. So he tried developing other watches at the same time. And it was really what is the entrepreneur. You make some attempts. You invest in developing different products. You hope that one of them will work, and you see. And after, he saw the Oyster works, and he pushed all his energy in this direction. But it's not, a genius that one day woke up and had the idea to make the Oyster. There's lots of uncertainty in the process of developing an innovation. And I think this is interesting to understand the beginning of Wilsdorf.
Absolutely. And you track the number of patents and trademarks. And he had many model lines, many different types of watches that he was creating before eventually settling on the Oyster and then the Oyster Perpetual. But he was trying lots of different models, case shapes, and innovations in watches, looking for that hit.
Yes, but it was common also in the watch industry, as I explained at that time. If you look at all the brand names, which would become famous later, had a broad range of products. It was the philosophy of selling watches at the time. It was not having a few core products, very easy to identify with the design. It's making anything as long as you can sell them. And the brand name was attached to the precision. If your watch is precise, it's enough to have a good reputation after you adapt the design. And that's what Wilsdorf targeted first. Precision was very important for the beginning, and after you adapt the design to the market.
Indeed. And what did Rolex do and Wilsdorf do in terms of telling the story of that precision or trying to make Rolex stand out from competitors?
First, we need to be aware that Rolex was quite a small company before the war. No, it was a small and a new company. And so the first objective of Wilsdorf was to catch up with the big names, with Omega, Longines, IWC, etc. And he was a follower in terms of communication. So he just wanted to establish his name, Rolex, as one of the best brands among precise watches. It's easy to say, but it was very hard to do, actually. So it's already a great achievement. When you start a company after 1900, you have already lots of big names established on the market. So he had a followers marketing strategy in his first period.
Absolutely. And then, you know, but trumpeting the certification that whether, you know, it cost came later, but the chronometer certification and the observatory achievements and wins, was this different Rolex doing this, or was this what everybody else was doing? You say, I mean, he was a follower basically, but he did establish Rolex's, you know, precision.
Yes, a few differences. For chronometry, he was among, very early on, Rolex was among the top five brands and fighting, especially with Omega, to have records in different observatories, etc. So it's not something very specific. But what was very specific is not really chronometry, but you have kind of watch office controls, you know, like what is a COSC today? At the origin of the COSC, you have these watch office controls, not observatories, delivering certificates for good quality of precision. And Wilsdorf and Egler, because they were together, they were among the first to understand the power of these certificates for communication, to mass advertise how numerous certificates you were able to get. Was very important. They were the first and soon copied by Omega, and Omega and Rolex, nearly until today, had a domination over what we would call later the COSC certificates.
And indeed, and you mentioned Aigler, which is the movement manufacturer based in Biel and Bien. Talk about how that relationship with Aigler, the movement manufacturer, differentiated Rolex and had basically two quite separate parts of this company, and they were separate companies that allowed Rolex to go down the path that it did. Talk about Aigler and how important they are to the history of Rolex.
Yeah, it's very important. As I said at the beginning, you know, Wilsdorf could focus on trade, marketing, and branding. He was able to do that because he had a good partner from very early on that supplied him very high quality watches. So there was a division of work between both. And all the job of Aigler was not to sell, it was to produce and to produce high quality watches. At the beginning, Aigler's factory goes back to the late 19th century, so before Rolex was born. And from very early on, he focused on high-quality watches and had different partners. This is very important to understand. Wilsdorf was only one of the main partners, of the main consumers, actually, of Aigler. And how should I say that? Aigler has different partners for different markets. He had a kind of division of the big markets in the world by consumer. So Wilsdorf had UK, Asia, and British Empire at the beginning. In America, it was Grünwatch. Mm-hmm. And then in Germany, they had different partners. So that's why Wilsdorf was not in the US before World War II, because Aigler had another partner. And if you think about that, you understand that the power balance between both partners, between Aigler and Wilsdorf, was in favor of Aigler. Aigler was stronger until the war because he was able to make good watches. And the relation changed after the war when Rolex became fast growing, and then Geneva, so the marketing side, became stronger than the producing side. As I had an access to the archives of the company, I don't know very well the capital of, relation between the two companies, the Bien manufacturer and the Geneva marketing company. But if you look at the board of members, as I explained in my book, you can see they share lots of board members, which suggests that there will very soon some cross-shareholding between both companies. So they were independent, but very, very close. They were managed as a whole from very early on.
Indeed. And I think you point out in the book that there is evidence at certain times that Aigler had shareholdings in Rolex, and Rolex had shareholdings in Aigler. Is that right?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
And, you know, you talked about the post-war period, but let's go back. I mean, you know, how did Rolex end up in Geneva and in Switzerland? I mean, you know, originally, it was started in London. It was Wilsdorf and Davis. And, you know, during the First World War, basically, is when that decision was made. What was it? It's kind of a contemporary or current topic because it had a lot to do with tariffs in the UK.
Yes, exactly. Tariffs and taxes. So the two main reasons, as you said, Rolex as a company started in the UK, and they imported watches from Switzerland and selling them to the British Empire. But then during World War One, two things changed in the business environment of Rolex due to the war. It was important to pay for the war, and the British government developed, among others, two important institutions. First is tariffs. You know, import tariffs became very expensive, and so if you import your watches from Switzerland to UK, of course you need to pay taxes. But when you have all your sales organization based in London, and when you re-export to another country, you know, it's a waste of money to pay taxes just to enter UK and then to re-export to another country. So the first point, to avoid these taxes when you re-export watches, what did Vizov do a lot. And second, also to pay for the war, the British government increased taxes on profit. Even if you make profit outside of the UK, you must pay taxes on that. And so Vizov didn't want to pay taxes for watches sold outside of the UK. And so for these two reasons, he moved the company to Switzerland. So you can export directly from Switzerland to your final country of destination. And taxes were much lower in Switzerland because Switzerland was not in a war. And it's the start of the Swiss fiscal paradise, by the way. Anyway, so it's for this reason that during the war, Vizov and some British employees also, as I mentioned in my book, he has some kind of funny articles in local newspapers in Switzerland saying that all these British employees come to Biel or to Geneva, maybe they're like spying how Swiss make watches, etc., etc. But actually, it was a transplantation of the company, Rolex company, to Switzerland, to Geneva from 1920.
Indeed. And so that transition, that move was made. How did the move to Switzerland impact Rolex in the short term and then over the long term? I mean, obviously Switzerland, you know, cemented itself as the center of fine watchmaking, but what did it mean for Rolex?
It means especially that product development was much more actively done by Vilstoff. You know, as long as you are based in London and you come a few times a year to Switzerland to buy watches, you don't have so much impact on product development. You trust completely Egler. But going back to Geneva, it's not only to sales, it's also for decoration. You know, case making, Vilstoff invested from very early on in the 20s in a case company. And then so you start to be closer to all the suppliers of external parts. You can start thinking about design, and you can start thinking about the Oyster, you know, making a waterproof watch. Because as I explained, Vilstoff toured a lot all the Jura region to talk to case makers, to buy patents and so on. So you must be in Switzerland to be close to suppliers to discuss and to develop your products.
And so let's talk about the Oyster case and then the Oyster Perpetual, the automatic movement. I mean, Rolex and Wilsdorf were not first in either of these things, but how did he and the company become known for the Oyster Perpetual? And, you know, what was the process of developing that waterproof and then automatic winding watch in Switzerland?
Yes, you're completely right. So it was kind of collective innovation, especially for the waterproof watch, because there were lots of case makers. It's more than watchmakers, it's a problem of the case, you know. So case makers were developing so waterproof or trying to make waterproof cases, applying to patents, etc. And what you can see is that Egler and Wilsdorf also applied for their own patents, but they also purchased patents a lot. So because they understood the power of these innovation, and they wanted to keep it for themselves. So there's a really a patent strategy, not only based on innovation, it's really to control an innovation and not to allow any copies. They went to the court also a lot against counterfeiters. So they really understood the power of being the only one to control this new product. And then, after, it's not enough to have technology and innovation, you need a narrative. And they understood that you need to communicate to consumers about the oysters. So oysters, the name itself shows that it's waterproof. And, you know, they displayed some oyster watches in aquariums, in some stores. They developed lots of stories with Mercedes Gleitzer, you know, swimming the channel. Is all these famous stories were put together to make the oyster a unique narrative for the consumers. But at the same time, they continued to develop a broad range of models because they didn't know it would work. That's how Wilsdorf worked. Now, integrating technological innovation in a narrative in developing a product. And for the perpetual movement, it's a bit similar. It was much more developed within the company. It was less a collective innovation, and it took much more time to make a stable, high-quality perpetual watch.
We're proud to have Panerai supporting the business of watches. For this episode, we're spotlighting the new PAM01574, a Luminor GMT Power Reserve in a sleek 44mm black ceramic case. It features a sandwich dial, dual-time functionality, a 3-day power reserve, and Panerai's new click-release strap system for easy swaps. This reference represents Panerai's forward-thinking approach to its Luminor collection, combining heritage, high-tech materials, and bold design. And it's just the beginning. Expect more exciting Luminor launches throughout 2025. Alongside The Depths of Time, a historical showcase taking place this October at Casa Panerai Madison in New York City, and this November at Panerai Miami Design District Boutique. Experience never-before-seen archival pieces and exciting novelties up close. Learn more at Panerai.com or check the show notes. Thanks again to Panerai for their support of the business of watches. And now, back to our chat with Pierre-Yves Danzé, author of Rolex, The Making of a Status Symbol. You know, you track in the book patents and trademark filings, and there's a distinct pattern with the company. There are certain periods which are extremely active and busy in terms of patents and trademark filings, and then there are others that are relatively quiet. Talk about those patterns and what was going on there.
Yeah, exactly. So Rolex didn't innovate at the same level during all its history. One important period is precisely from the early 20s to just after World War II. Lots of innovation to develop the waterproof case and the perpetual movement, and after also developing the after the war, all these famous collections that would make Rolex over famous. But once this portfolio of product was nearly finished with the Cosmograph, Rolex stopped innovating technically for a while because I had developed enough goods, enough product for different technical watches, you know, for the chronometer, the diving watch, etc., etc. Then they stopped innovating in terms of product development, focusing more on marketing in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s.
Indeed, and you know, as you point out, in the 1950s, basically those model lines and then up to the Cosmograph, I guess, in 1963. I mean, you know, those are the models that we basically still see today that keep getting iterated on and slowly improved. You know, talk about how Rolex was able to basically come to the conclusion that they had the models and the watches that could carry them forward, and how, you know, small that was in terms of a model lineup as compared to what they had been and their competitors. It was very focused.
Exactly, exactly. This is the first point, very, very important, because this is what we call the global models, you know, in global communication. Before the war, companies, Rolex included, had a very, very broad range of products for each market, for each consumer. They developed different design. But it started to change during the war, just after the war. It's not only Rolex. Omega was a promoter with the Constellation and these models. And here, Rolex was still a follower. But the difference is, as you said, they were much more focused. They gave up other non-global products. So nearly all the products of Rolex were global. So it means global, it means the same image, the same design, the same name around the world. A Cosmograph is a Cosmograph everywhere, same price, same design, same communication. And they didn't allow, nearly didn't allow, watches that didn't enter these collections. So this is how Rolex is important. And second, what is important in the 60s, and it was a marketing innovation of Heiniger, who succeeded Wilsdorf. What he did actually is when he started this strategy, this narrative on the excellence of the consumers on making a Rolex a watch of successful people and powerful people. The idea is that if we have made the perfection, we have the perfect watches, you don't need to update perfection, actually. It makes your narrative much more powerful, you know? If you claim they're the best, the Cosmograph is the best chronograph, what should you develop a new one in a few years later? Now, we keep focused on that. It made the narrative on perfection really, really relevant. And after, you can focus on the consumers, how our consumers are also excellent people, are also the best, like our watches are the best. And so that's why I argue in this book that Heiniger, who made Rolex the status symbol, was very conservative for product development, ultra-conservative, but very innovative, revolutionary for marketing.
Indeed, yeah, let's talk about that, because obviously Hans Wilsdorf dies in 1960. He had already set up the Hans Wilsdorf Foundation, which just sort of oversaw the governance and structure of Rolex. But indeed, what was, because obviously succession can be a major issue for many companies, how did it go at Rolex, and how was it governed? Because there were, contrary to a lot of the narrative that's out there, there were relatives of Hans Wilsdorf at the company who were in executive positions. What happened there? Why did, for example, the nephew of Hans Wilsdorf not end up running Rolex?
Yes, the foundation, Wilsdorf Foundation, as you say, became the owner of the company when Wilsdorf died, but no, that is 1960, but you need anyway to appoint a new CEO to run the company. And there were a team around Wilsdorf, a team of executives, five or six, and one of them was his nephew. And my assumption was that he wanted his nephew to succeed him because he asked him to take his name, Wilsdorf, and he appointed him director when he was in his late 20s, or a very young executive. Taking the name of Wilsdorf shows a will to continue of the family business. But the new owner in 1960, Wilsdorf Foundation, didn't appoint any CEO. It was still a team of executives without a boss, which is quite quite strange, but it means there's some conflicts between the owners. You know, why should we appoint a young nephew to run such a company? It's too risky. Maybe he was not talented enough. And they understood among the team was another guy who was much more promising. He was André Heiniger, the sales director. And he became CEO in 1963 or 4, around these years. We don't know exactly the dates, but it means during 3-4 years was now CEO. And then Heiniger was able to establish as the most powerful among them.
How did, and you alluded to it before, but the model lines and the watches had been established, the excellent watches. And so the narrative and the focus, obviously the manufacturer with Aigler in Bien continued, but the focus then for the company became with marketing, image, and talking about the Rolex customer. So talk about that, how the narrative developed of these excellent watches that, created by an excellent man for an excellent consumer. This is really an important factor in differentiating Rolex, isn't it, compared to their competitors?
Yeah, I think it's the most important factor, because other companies had also good watches, excellent watches, but Rolex was the first to stop talking about products and to talk about who were its consumers in the 60s, mostly. If you look at advertisement of all other companies, they still talk about watches and why watches are good, precise, excellent. But at the same time, Rolex stopped talking about watches. They stopped chronometry competition. They're talking about, a story of consumers using their product to show how special they are, how excellent they are. And this idea was not a Swiss idea. Swiss were good at engineering or making the best watches, but they were not good at selling watches. So this knowledge came from outside. It came from the US, because Americans are very good at selling things, as we know. Or more precisely, it was a company, J. Walter Thompson, which was the largest advertising company of the world after World War II. And there was some personal connections between Winsdorf and a Swiss employee from a former Swiss employee of this company. And so these relations through the London agency of this American firm started. Mm-hmm. And I used the archives of this firm and these archives are available, and they show precisely what happened during the meetings between the Swiss engineers and the US marketers. And what is very interesting, just after the war, the Americans were complaining that the Swiss came with new product and wanted to communicate with innovation, with technical facts. And the American said, it's finished. We shouldn't talk about that. We should talk about a nice story about the users, to show the excellence of the users. And so that's what they did.
Talk about some of the advertising campaigns. I mean, this is the era when we see the famous campaigns. I mean, if you were speaking at the United Nations tomorrow, you'd be wearing a Rolex. If you're flying the Concorde tomorrow, you'd be wearing a Rolex. Yeah, talk about, and this is, really coming from the American side of the agency, J. Walter Thompson. This is critical.
Even if it was a London agency first, but they were American in London mostly. So it was really an American idea. And it started in the 50s, as you said, with this company. If you would talk at the United Nations, you would wear a Rolex and so on. It starts focusing on the men of power, politicians, military, etc. But especially military and state men in the 50s. The idea of the powerful men or white men, especially. And that what changed in the 60s with social change, sexual revolution, etc. It's clearly explained in the documents of the agency that we need to adapt a bit this talk, because people are not fascinated so much by politicians anymore. They are much more attractive men actually in society that come from sports, from business, from adventure, or for culture later. But from the 60s, we can see, for example, one of the first examples, a very good example is the golfer, the American golfer, Arnold Palmer. He was a star around the world, and he was an excellent golfer, living, excellent life. And so he embodied these values of Rolex, and people could identify with him because he was seen as a cool guy that we wanted to follow him. Jean-Claude Killy in ski is exactly the same. But men, I'm talking about just on purpose on men, because Rolex was still a brand for men. Even if there were watches for women, but all the narrative was focused on men. And no more the powerful man, but the successful man, always with excellence.
It wasn't only sports figures. There's a part in your book where you highlight, I believe it's Arnold Palmer's agent, International Management, who is also highlighted in a in advertising as the kind of Rolex man, the Rolex customer.
Yes, exactly. Company managers, entrepreneurs were also very, very, very important. Or there's also a CEO of Pan Am, or these very mm-hmm. successful businessmen were a target as consumers of Rolex, but also for the narrative to show, we can identify. We want, if you are a white man from middle classes in the 60s, you would like to become a successful businessman or successful sportsman, and you can identify to this narrative.
And at this point, talk about where Rolex was in the market in terms of sales and compared to its competitors. I guess this is the 1960s and leading up to when Rolex sort of consolidates its position at the top of the market. But where were they in production and where were they in price compared to others? I mean, this was still an attainable watch for the middle class.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I have lots of numbers in my books about the evolution of the price from the 50s until today, but gross sales or estimates of gross sales are used as some interviews of CEOs, sometimes the New York Times, or more recently the numbers given by Vontobel Bank or mm-hmm. Morgan Stanley. I'm not going to repeat all these numbers here.
Sure.
But what we can see is the position, which is important, is it's what I call accessible luxury, which was a segment which did not exist so much in the 60s. You had normal watches, precise watches, a bit pricey because they are very precise, and you had a few luxury brands, like Vacheron Constantin, Patek Philippe, very pricey because they use gold, diamonds, and etc. They have complications. It was not the position of Rolex. It's not making a few luxury watches. It's to target the mass market. It's tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands of very high quality watches. And then if you want to sell volumes, you need to be positioned in a mid market. And at the time, the target was middle classes or upper middle classes. So it was not inaccessible for most of people. And it stayed in this position for a very, very long time. And what made the success, it started in the late 60s in the US, with economic growth, with also social change, all men, especially men in the cities of the eastern coast, New York, Boston, etc., loved this story about excellence, social distinction through a product. It was completely new in the watch industry, and it made Rolex successful from the late 60s. According to my estimates, Rolex overcame Omega and established as number one in the late 60s, and kept this position today.
Indeed, and the key to this is making a Rolex watch a status symbol, a symbol of success, and that is that all through marketing and testimonies. I mean, what other ways does Rolex convey that idea and that position as a status symbol. I mean, it becomes associated with specific sporting events and sports at this point, but certainly not all. It's very specific.
Yeah, as we say, advertisements, they selected very strictly the magazines and newspapers where they appeared. This is very, very important. They selected very well the ambassadors from sports, from culture, and always to be selective. You know, they were among the first to go to Polo, for example. It was identified as a good target where nobody was, and it was so the idea of social distinction or starting to go to culture, started especially with a partnership with Placingo Domingo in Singapore. When there was an important concert in Singapore, it was an opportunity to move to Singapore and to culture, because the classic music and then later cinema were understood to be also in an embodiment of excellence. And then finally, you have also the Rolex Prize for Enterprise, which shows exactly the same, that, you know, it's special people, excellent people are awarded by the company to achieve their dreams because they are excellent. It started in the earlier 70s.
So, at this period in the Swiss watchmaking industry, we're headed, in the 1970s, 75 to 85. I mean, this is, what some call the quartz crisis, others call the quartz revolution. You've written books on this, but talk about, what happened to the industry, but specifically how Rolex operated, and the outcome for Rolex was completely different. This is where Rolex truly cemented its place at the top of the Swiss watch industry.
Yeah, this was an important turning point. A first point important to have in mind when you talk about that is that the Swiss were not late in developing quartz watches. So Japanese was the first to market, to launch the market a quartz watch, the Seiko Astron, in 1969. But the first prototype was Swiss. So Swiss were from 66. So the Swiss were very good at making research, like the Japanese or the American. Making prototypes was easy. And Rolex developed its own prototypes also from the late 60s, early 70s, because the management understood that we need to be able to master this technology in case of. It was not to sell it. It was to master it. So Rolex was able to have quartz watches. They produced a few, but they kept focused on their own collections. They didn't develop specific collection for quartz watches. The aesthetics kept the same, and the message kept positioned at the same. Why? Because Rolex was not a watch any longer. It was a discourse, a narrative on excellence, and you don't care about quartz. It's better to keep focused and as you are. If you continue in mechanical watches, you can still claim, as I explained before, that if you make already the perfect watch, you don't need to update it, and you continue as you are. And Rolex never felt any crisis, or never. They felt for 1 or 2 years decline of sales, but it was also high Swiss franc at the same time. In a long-term perspective, there's no crisis at all for Rolex during the 70s. But for competitors, if you think about Omega, which was the most important competitors, they decided to shift. They decided for a strategic shift to quartz. No more chronometers with mechanical watches. It's quartz for the future, like Seiko did in Japan. And then, all your narratives and marketing strategy must or should follow also this change. And it was the big fail of Omega during the watch crisis. And that's also one of the reasons why Rolex was able to strengthen its position as number one in the world, because it was not a watch anymore.
Indeed. But it was quite interesting to me, and I hadn't realized that I think in around 1975, with that strong franc and with the crisis that was going on, Rolex actually slowed down production, actually used short-time work for a very brief period of time, and they certainly were impacted by the crisis for a brief period of time. But then over the same period, they basically doubled the number of employees they had and their production, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly so. I don't know the exact reasons of the 2 years of decline of production. It should be in the archives somewhere. But what is important is that it is a comeback. You know, after a few years, it is going back to growth. While for other companies, is when the crisis became more and more important. So the first sign of the crisis in Switzerland is due to high Swiss franc. You know, at the end of Bretton Woods and oil shock, the Swiss franc became suddenly very high and all the industry collapsed after 74. So of course, Rolex was also impacted, but I would argue it's kind of conjunctural crisis. It's not something structural due to technical change and et cetera.
You know, we touched on it before, but let's talk more about, I mean, all the advertising, the messaging really seemed to be centered around men of excellence, men of power, and Rolex as a status symbol. You know, how did Rolex is a very strong player in the women's watch market today, and this started quite a long time ago. How did they carve out that area in the market and that, you know, was perhaps different than some of their competitors?
Yeah, at first they had different watches outside of the main narrative, of course, because the narrative was centered on men, and they had different models. The collection Cellini, for example, had lots of watches for women, and the narrative was not excellent. You know, it is something a bit different. In sense of the American agency said in the late 60s, early 70s, that they should stop doing this strict separation, explaining that some women also like this idea of status symbol, this idea of success. It's not only a value for men, a woman can identify themselves with that. So for that, you need both to develop Oyster models for women using the same design, but smaller, etc., what the company did from that point. And second, you need also to adapt your narratives, your advertisement, to use also women of excellence. And it's when, during the 70s, the Rolex started also to have women ambassadors, especially from tennis.
Yes.
I have a picture in the book about that, you know, tennis woman, but showing exactly the same message. Is excellent. So women can also be excellent and can also like this message and on social status. And then after it continued to develop in this direction. So no more, or just a half separation, still some watches specifically addressed to women, but mostly, as we have today, it's within the same collections.
Yes. And what is your, you know, from your research and understanding, I mean, do you have any estimate in terms of, you know, what percentage of sales are to women or what would be seen as women's watches and how that's changed?
No, I don't have any precise numbers or estimates, unfortunately.
Indeed, and that speaks to the difficulty in reporting on and creating the history of Rolex, because as you say, I mean, you know, there are archives. You haven't had access to them. You have to find sources elsewhere to build your story and your narrative. I mean, is that secrecy an important part of the Rolex story? I suppose it is, in terms of them telling their own story and controlling the narrative.
Yes, secrecy is important, because it makes all of this narrative based on excellence even stronger. More, I would say, more than secrecy is silence, which is important. You don't talk. We don't need to talk. Just look at the product, and that's enough. And it's, you know, even today, CEO Dufour is nearly never interviewed. There are a few exceptions, but it's Heiniger had nearly no interviews. So it has a long tradition for more than 50 years not to talk to the media because just look at the watch and there's nothing to say. So it's a very powerful position. If you start to talk too much, like other CEOs for many other brands, they talk about themselves, what they do, etc. But we don't need to talk about, we don't do anything. Just look at the product. Yep. This is the best. And there's nothing to add. It's very powerful if you think in this direction. So that's why silence is very important.
Yes, no, it's a very good point. And you talked about the different CEOs. There's Mr. Heiniger, and his son was a CEO at some point. I mean, talk about the CEOs that Rolex has had over the years since Hans Wilsdorf, and also then the governance of both Montreux Rolex SA, now Rolex SA, and then the Hans Wilsdorf Foundation. What kind of people were on the boards of these two entities over the years, and how has it changed?
For a long time, people were very similar between the foundation, with the foundation and the boards of Rolex. There were people from outside of watch business, actually, from high families, haute bourgeoisie from Geneva, working in finance, university professors, lawyers, etc. So they were checking if the business was going well, but they were not executive directors. They didn't participate in the business of the company. Even in the board of Rolex, there were representatives of the foundation also to check if everything was going well, especially for finance. Finance is an important part of the story. And what changed is during the last 10 years with the arrival of Dufour, we can observe that in Rolex boards, we have people from the luxury business, from different other companies with an experience in luxury business that are appointed. They have no relation with the Wilsdorf Foundation, but they have knowledge about luxury business. And my assumption is that they support somehow Dufour sometimes with some advice for some specific issues to be really a powerful luxury company. And it works very well because under Dufour, Rolex sales doubled and it's really, really recognized as a very modern luxury brand today.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so, yeah, there's more expertise on the board these days in terms of the product category, and that has translated into more sales. Could just talk briefly about the structure of, you know, the foundation, the revenue that Rolex SA generates, and how that gets distributed, and how that is obviously different than other watch brands.
So yeah, Rolex is not listed. Rolex has only one shareholder, which is Wilsdorf Foundation. It's a foundation, so they don't need to advertise anything. So that's why we don't know anything about the business. But I make a comparison in my book with Richemont and Swatch Group from the 90s, showing that they distributed billions of Swiss francs as dividends, or especially like Richemont, to purchase their own shares. That's something that Rolex doesn't have to do. So all these billions not distributed or wasted through share repurchase are reinvested in finance by Wilsdorf Foundation, which is really, really rich. We don't know very, very well. I have a few numbers in the book, some estimates. But what is important, it gives freedom to Rolex because they have cash. They have enough cash to purchase a company, to develop the firm. So they don't rely on banks. They don't rely on financial markets. They are free and independent thanks to all of this money accumulated over the year and reinvested, which is something very important, especially if you compare with other luxury companies that distribute so much money to their owners.
Indeed. And you know, one of the things we've seen that deployment of capital has been in consolidating most of the company's suppliers, components, makers, and obviously Aigler, being the most important one in 2004. And then the Boucher acquisition, a retailer, a couple of years ago. Do you expect that sort of, you know, consolidation to continue for Rolex to become even more vertically integrated from production to retail? Is that where they're going?
I don't know at all, but if you look at history, you can see a long-term perspective from the 90s during the last 30 years. As you say, there's a vertical integration which started with production. And they have nearly verticalized everything. So now they do everything by their own, and they started to move to retail. So some business journalists say it's just an opportunity to take over Boucher, but we never know. Is it an opportunity or the first step of something bigger? We don't know yet, but they have cash. They have already verticalized all production. So it looks very natural to continue integration. With retail.
And, you know, in the past couple of years, we've seen some interesting new sort of product development from Rolex. Obviously, we've just seen the Land Dweller, which design-wise seems to be quite an amalgam of previous Rolex models, but is the innovation of a new escapement, a new high-frequency movement for Rolex. You know, those changes in product that we've seen over the past couple of years, what does that tell you about the business strategy at this point, if anything at all?
No, it's very, very important. And it showed that the company is not ultra conservative as it used to be with Heineken, because consumers are changing and you need also to show that you innovate somehow, like competitors, like Audemars Piguet and others, always do something a bit new technically to show you are still on the top of the watch history. So, in some sense, but you do that within a kind of aesthetical framework, which is Rolex. So don't try to launch a completely different product. Technically, is new, but if you look at the design, you recognize is a Rolex. And this is very, very well done, I think. You integrate innovation within your tradition, within your general narrative of excellence. So it doesn't break all the work done until that time about how excellent as a watch is developed during the 50s and early 60s.
And last thing, I mean, what in all your research for this book, what for you was the most surprising or interesting or, you know, newfound discovery you think that you made in that effort?
The most surprising was these meetings between the manager from Geneva and the marketers from New York. Collaboration between Rolex and John Walter Thompson showed really that the American side had a very important role in building the strategy. They were not only the suppliers of your nice pictures for advertisement, but they contributed to really make the strategy. And before looking at the archives, I thought they had a more passive role. They were just, you know, following the request from Geneva, but it's not the case. It's really a cooperation, a co-creation. The idea of Rolex as a status symbol is both a Swiss and an American innovation.
Well, we should probably leave it there. But Pierre-Yves Danzay, professor of business history, thank you very much for joining us. And yeah, we look forward to your next academic work on the Swiss watch industry.
Thanks a lot, Andy, for the invitation.
And that's the business of watches for this episode. We hope you enjoyed. Please head on over to hodinkee.com where you can join the discussion and leave any comments or questions about this episode or the business of watches in general. Who knows? We might even answer your question on a future episode. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh episode of The Business of Watches. Until then, I'm Andy Hoffman, and I'll see you on HoDinky.com.